Don't sweat the small stuff. Forgive yourself. Put people first. Life advice comes at us from all directions. Some stuff rises to the top, and we're talking about the more helpful morsels here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're on a search for how to live a happy life, and we're asking for life advice, gathering your questions that keep you up at night. We're at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about relationships? Do the people you love often think you don't care much about them and you wish you knew how to prioritize making them feel loved? Do you have no idea how to make the people you feel loved? Elizabeth Bernstein is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She writes a column called Bonds, which is all about relationships. Elizabeth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me this morning.
You receive thousands of letters, lots of mail from people every year asking about all things in life. What are some of the most common themes? What rises to the top?
You know, the main theme really is connectivity. How can people connect better with, as you say, with the people you love? And how can I talk to them better? How can I express my love? Lots of the letters are frustrated. Something happened. What do I do? And then there's some other themes. People want to know how to tell someone. A very big one is how to tell someone they love them if they haven't, how to repair a relationship, how to talk about the end of life, how to talk about death before it's too late. Tell somebody you love them then. Get a lot of letters about sex because that is an ongoing fascination among
sure.
people. Letters about how do I apologize, loneliness. It really, and a whole lot, another sort of big area is, you know, how to be happy, but also people who are depressed. Hey, I'm really struggling. What do I do?
Well, let's look at one of these areas, starting out with being alone. You also address, you know, people wondering if they'll be okay alone. Why do you think loneliness is something people worry a lot about?
It gives people anxiety. We're social creatures. I mean, if you go way, way back in our evolutionary period, we're sort of created like to live in packs. And when you're outside that pack, you're a little more vulnerable, or a lot more vulnerable if you think about a time when a mastodon might come and, like, pick you off. So you're vulnerable outside of that pack. It's really built deep into our DNA. And so we connect, and also just now it's helpful, right? It's much easier to pay a mortgage with, you know, two incomes. It's, you know, easier to get a lot done parenting. You know, we need other people. That's really built into our fabric.
You write in one of your pieces that many lonely people wish they had social plans or a bigger network of friends to call upon, but sometimes even when they do, they avoid contact, and this can lead to a downward spiral of more loneliness. So what can people do to overcome this tendency?
You really have to push yourself. So, you know, people who have fewer social ties, maybe you've moved and it's a temporary thing, or you've gotten divorced, or there's been a death of, you know, a spouse and your circumstances have changed. But some people by nature are more loners, really, or they have some social anxiety. And also when you're depressed, when you're down, you don't have the energy to keep up the social ties. And there's something sort of in that depressive process that tells you to isolate, which is very harmful. So what can people do? They really have to push through whatever it is, the shyness, the fear that someone's going to reject them if they reach out. If you just remind yourself, like, hey, most people are scared of being lonely. We all worry about it and deal with it at different times. No one's going to fault you. There's no stigma on being lonely, or there shouldn't be. You shouldn't feel shamed.
We're talking with Elizabeth Bernstein. She's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she writes a column there called Bonds, which is about relationships. Gathering your questions, they're welcome. 800-642-1234. You can send your relationship questions, from the family ones to the friendship to the questions about yourself. You have a line at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Elizabeth, you also field questions from people about how to deal with those who just, you know, flat out irritate you, many people who are perhaps family members. Why do you think the people who we're supposed to love most also tend to get on our nerves the most?
because they were around them the most. That's one piece of it. But also, we can let our guard down. We try to be in our best behavior for strangers and people we don't know very well, or hopefully in the workplace. But the closer we get to people, the more we let them see the real us. And so then there's this danger that we're not even polite after a while. And certainly there's things in families like competition among siblings, even adult siblings, or wounds, old wounds maybe from childhood, emotional wounds. And so these things all add up to some pretty serious problems between people.
Oh, because things can just build and build both inside of you and another family member, perhaps.
Exactly. And there's resentment and hurt, and this was never really repaired. You never said you're sorry. And this could be something little, you forgot my birthday, or it could be something very, very big. You weren't there during my childhood. You're my parent. And so these things do foster and need to be dealt with.
Well, let's look at couples now. A lot of times couples disagree. There is a couple you wrote about, Joe and Carrie. Both of them believed their own version of events were more reliable when it came to an argument they had over whether Joe told Carrie he was buying an arcade machine from eBay. And Elizabeth, how can we handle these types of arguments, which can be, who's right here?
And that's just it. Probably both of them. Their memories, our memories are all different. Memories are very subjective. So, that was a good couple. So, suddenly, you think you okay the arcade machine as it's coming in the door to be set up in your basement, but there can be a big problem like that. So, we both have versions. We have to, address the issue maybe, earlier on and communicate better. And, certainly denial is a powerful thing. And if you wanted to, say, move an arcade machine, buy it and put it in the dining room, you might not be as clear as you should about that. You might talk around the issue, and that's where the problem becomes. So better communication is helpful. And then you really have to, when you argue, you have to do several things. You have to just focus on the matter at hand. You can't throw in, you're mad about that arcade machine in your kitchen. You cannot throw in everything, the kitchen sink, everything. You can't be mad about something 2 years ago. You just have to focus on the issue. And you have to speak compassionately. You have to really dial down the anger.
Yeah, but it's so hard for things to spiral if the other spouse, brings something else into the argument, and then you're kind of like one-upping. You're going to bring something in.
Oh, exactly. You're going to one-up them. I'm a big fan of deep breathing. I mean, I deep breathe, and I'm a big fan of doing it in the middle of a heated conversation, in the middle of a deadline, when the plane ride gets turbulent. Like, deep breathing can reset your circulation, your nervous system, actually. Like, it can, help you calm it down. And so if you can sort of take a few deep breaths, you can say, hey, you know what, I want to talk to you. You're important to me. This conversation's important. I don't want to escalate it. Let me take a walk. Let me, go to the other room for a few minutes. I'm going to come back calmer. You want to actively work on yourself to be calmer and sort of notice, if the other person's, throwing in an argument from 2 years ago and escalating it, you can still try to do the right thing and stop that escalation right there.
We're getting useful tips on how to do stuff better and be better at relationships. Elizabeth Bernstein is with us. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and her column is called Bonds. It's all about relationships. Do the people you love think you don't care enough about them and you wish you knew how to prioritize making them feel loved? Do you have no idea how to make the people you feel you love feel loved? What questions do you have for the relationship columnist? Bring them on at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Find your passion, be authentic, share your story. Recent words of advice from lifestyle icon Martha Stewart in a recent keynote speech she gave. We're getting life advice to put to use here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's some more advice along the lines of, to be good to yourself, do one nice thing for yourself and one nice thing for someone else each day. What's the best advice you've received in love and in life? Are you working through perhaps an end-of-life relationship? Do you have a loved one who's dying and you don't know how to talk with them? Your relationship questions, they matter. They're welcome at 800-642-1234. Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Bernstein stays with us, and she writes the Bonds column, which is about relationships. Let's go to the phones now with Marianne joining us from Superior. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning. One of the things that I have found, people always say, well, you're so friendly. I did not come out of the womb shaking hands. And friendliness for me begins with a hello, whether it's in my neighborhood, the apartment complex, or if you're shopping. Sometimes just looking at someone in the eyes and saying hello can begin a conversation. I see so much loneliness. And then if you can stop and listen, people have such wonderful stories if you can just take a little time and really listen to them.
Marianne, thank you so much for the call. Elizabeth, it sounds like Marianne is saying friendliness is something you work on. It is something you work on through life.
It really is, or if it doesn't come naturally to you, as Marianne says, it doesn't come to her. You can, and that's just what she just said is so beautiful. Can you imagine what a better place it would be if we all were just saying hello and being kind in line and hearing each other's stories? Because on a very sort of basic level inside us, that's what we all want, is to be seen and heard and just cared about. And strangers, our interactions with strangers through the day. Like, research shows they can really boost our mood a lot, because they can alleviate some of that loneliness, even just a few minutes at the store. But also, they aren't the people we're arguing with and we're annoyed with. So there's no baggage to that relationship, really. But, I mean, her sentiment is so wonderful.
Elizabeth, you write about how to talk to a loved one who is dying, and you start the column with an anecdote about a person whose partner is dying, and he tells her he's not going to be around much longer, and she responds by telling him not to talk that way. So do people often ask you about how to talk to their dying loved one?
They do. And this column that you're mentioning, I've written my column for almost 10 years on relationships. This column is the most popular one. It was the one that was the most read. And it's because I think this is such a sticky issue. We fear it more than anything. We're going to lose a loved one for good. And as that time is coming up, many times we know it's happening, right? This person, we're losing them. They're sick. Something's, you know, we're going to lose them. We tend to go down double down into denial. And it's very easy to do. It seems like a compassionate thing to do. I don't want to mention this. I don't want to hurt the person who's dying. I don't want to remind them. The dying person doesn't want to cause anxiety for the survivors. So we don't talk about it. And that's not kind to either person. It's very stressful and can be very hurtful. And it can leave you without this like sense of really connecting, you know, at a time that's so important and showing love.
So how would you recommend people talk to a partner, a friend, or a family member who is about to pass?
You know, so for this one, you have to really, again, you have to push through sort of your feeling that, you know, I shouldn't. And maybe the other person doesn't want to. Look, if the person who's, you have someone who's dying and they don't want to talk, don't push it. You're supposed to be kind to them right now, right? But, you know, you should test that. See if they do. Bring it up. Say, look, you can share your feelings. There's something I wanted to tell you. I'm really scared. I'm going to miss you. I loved you. Many times, the first time people are saying I love you to someone is at this end of life stage. So you can do it. You could write it down if you're nervous. Write it down and read it. Say, look, I want to read you this. I was too scared. I think I'll cry. Let me, you know, read it to you. So you can do that. And you can. There's different types of things people even talk about at that end of life. They can talk about, you know, the dead dying person can, you know, talk about what their hopes for you are, what they hope they'll have you do. That can be very powerful. Years ago, my grandfather, when he was dying many years ago, I was in college, said, you know, I hope you become a writer. I hope you, it'll be hard. I hope you stick with it, Elizabeth. And that really helped me. It still helps me. Like, I hear his voice, like, you know, on every deadline, don't drop the ball here. but, you know, so you can have these identity messages. You can, you know, talk about the afterlife if you're religious or spiritual. You know, you can have everyday talk. You could just spend time together and let that person keep living till the last moment. It's really important.
Many of the questions people submit to you are really about them wanting your validation. They want to hear that they're normal, that they're okay, or that they made the right move, the right decision. Why do you think people need this reinforcement?
We get in so far into our own heads, like this is where we live. So we get so far into our own heads, we're very worried, and then your problem tends to take on this larger life. Like everybody knows I'm lonely. How ashamed am I that I don't have any friends or anybody to turn to? It's not like that. Like people they're not shaming usually by nature. And also we sort of lose this context or this understanding that our problems are pretty universal. You know, and I see this across the board from people worried that they're depressed or lonely or they're having a problem in their marriage to people just worried. You know, I write about a lot of sex research. People are worried with that. Like, hey, I don't know if I'm doing it right. Well, you know, if you thought this up, you're probably doing what someone else thought up.
And, you know, just even the act of reaching out for advice, to have to write it down, to have to go through the motions of thinking through what this is that is keeping someone up at night, that is therapeutic in itself.
You know, it is. It's, you know, people, I'm always struck by the number of people who write me and say, I got one this week who say, you know, I'm up, it's 2 a.m. and I was Googling the answer to whatever their relationship problem is or whatever they're worried about. This is someone worried about her son in college who she thought was suicidal. So I'm very worried. What do I do? I found your article. Can you give me more advice? And what always strikes me is, wow, like how lonely, how desperate we are for sort of these answers on relationships and how to relate. If we're up Googling like a reporter, you know, in the middle of the night, I always feel a little worried, like, whoa, you found me. I better have the best advice. But there's a great deal of like we're alone in our problems out there. And, you know, maybe the answer is, you know, across the hall or, you know, even, you know, across the bed. Like talk to the people around you. Just keep connecting.
What is the favorite question you've ever received? Something that you just hold close, that you just absolutely love?
You know, I love the ones that sort of, I can answer. The ones where I have a good answer. Some of them are just cute, I think. Like, I love the woman who wrote me and said, hey, you know, wrote about, you know, long-term marriage and sex in long-term marriage and how couples keep a spark alive. I deeply love my husband. Can you tell me how I could become attracted to him? Yeah, I think that's a really always, like, a charming one. Or, you know, I like the ones where they're just trying to connect again. Or, you know, just can you, you know, one woman wrote once, I had a fight with my husband. It was about a sponge in the kitchen. Neither one, like, why isn't it clean in the sink? Why is it still hanging out on the stove? You know, so like these ones that are really sort of universal, right? Who hasn't thought about some version of the sponge in the sink? So even though that was a problem and deep enough to make this woman write a stranger, write a relationship columnist, but it's so universal. Like we all know what that feeling is and how we want to de-escalate the sponge fight.
So among the thousands of letters you get from readers each year, sometimes people send you their own advice, apparently. What's some of your favorite advice that people have sent to you?
You know, my all-time favorite was from a man in his 80s. He said, you know, I'm 82, and I've thought a lot about life, and I've seen a lot of changes. I've seen relationships. I've seen political changes. I'm going to give you, just out of the blue, Elizabeth, I'm going to give you the very best advice, and it's brilliant. He said, I have this
bucket, and he had a name for it. It rhymes with bucket, but he's had this bucket in my head, and I put everything there that I just don't want to deal with. And it could be a politician I don't like. It can be, you know, the stock market went down today. It can be my wife drove me nuts.
Things that are out of his control.
Things that are out of my control. Not my wife. But, you know, that I love her, and you want to see her. But you know, somebody annoyed me. Somebody cut me off in traffic. You know, somebody's on TV annoying. I'm going to put this in this sort of bucket in my head, this imaginary bucket, and I'm just going to let it go. It just sits there. I'm going to dump that bucket out. And it really is brilliant advice, like to put these things. There's nothing, if you're at, Thanksgiving dinner and, you know, your adult siblings snipes at you, like there's nothing you can do. Just put it in your head away, let it go, let it float away, and move on with your day and your meal and, you know, the love. And so I just hold that one really deep. He and I now are like occasional sort of email pen pals, and he's always got excellent advice. So, you know, and well-earned advice, I assume.
Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Bernstein is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She writes a column called Bonds, which is all about relationships. Coming up, Wisconsin has the lowest pay rate in the nation for public defenders. We'll look what's behind it here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about public defender pay in Wisconsin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Public defenders are criminal defense attorneys who are paid to defend people accused of crimes who are unable to pay a private attorney. And Wisconsin has the worst rate of pay in the country for private lawyers who are assigned to represent clients who can't afford a lawyer. And that's making it more difficult to find attorneys to take these cases. How do you feel about the rate of pay for private attorneys in Wisconsin taking on public defense cases? Is $40 an hour inadequate? Are you an attorney? And if so, what are your thoughts on fixing the system? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior. She's host of the regional program Hear Me Out. Danny, welcome back.
Hi, Kate.
So before we get into the actual pay situation, can you explain how the public defense system works in Wisconsin?
Sure. So the public defender's office has staff attorneys, and they represent indigent clients. In other words, people who can't afford it. And so they're the ones that take those cases where a person can't afford to pay for a private attorney to represent them in cases where they've been charged with a crime.
And so these staff attorneys take on the majority of those cases, I think roughly 60%, but then 40% are farmed out, if you will, to private attorneys?
Yeah, the office handles about 138,000 cases a year, and there are times when they see cases where there are multiple defendants. A lot of the times now it's happening because of the drug problems that we're seeing across the entire state with opioid abuse or with methamphetamine. And so usually when there's a sting or a lot of these people are brought in on charges, you have multiple defendants charged with crimes. And that means that the public defender's office can't represent all of those clients. And so they have to find other attorneys to represent them.
Oh, is it an issue? The workload is too much? This just too much to do?
It's just, it represents a conflict.
Okay.
So they have to find someone else to take those cases.
So what about the pay rate for private attorneys taking on public defense cases at a $40 per hour? It's the lowest in the nation. How did we get here?
Yeah. Well, we got here because the legislature actually lowered this rate in 1995. It's only $5 more than the rate that was set in 1978. And there have been a handful of bills that have been proposed to address this issue, whether it's through a tiered system or just increasing the rate flat out. But all of those proposals have not advanced in the legislature. And budget proposals where the state public defender's office has requested an increase in the rate have not been heard by both Democratic or Republican governors. So that's why we're here right now.
So would this $40 per hour rate be considered like pro bono work for private attorneys? Is $40 so low that they're basically considering, hey, we're just doing this for free?
Yeah, I mean, they're losing money on it for sure. I mean, most private attorneys are because they have an office to maintain, and that means that there's overhead related to keeping their office running. And a report that came out from the Sixth Amendment Center based in Boston found that a private attorney would have to charge an average of about $42 an hour in order to make cost, just to break even. So right now they're losing money when they take these cases.
What are we hearing from private attorneys about the $40 an hour rate?
That it's far too low, that they can't afford it economically to take on these cases because they, cases take a lot of time and investment to do it right. And if they're going to be compensated at $40 an hour, that just doesn't work for them. A lot of them make 4 or 5 times that amount on private criminal defense cases. So it's really hard for them to justify taking on a public defender case when they can make way more money doing their private practice.
What are they saying about what would be a more acceptable rate? What might that look like to them?
It varies. I think a lot of attorneys agree that just bringing the rate up to $70 an hour would be an improvement, but it wouldn't fix the problem in their mind. And part of the reason for that is because the Supreme Court raised the court-appointed rate for attorneys to $100 an hour. And that is going to take effect next year. And so even if the public defender's office were to raise the rate to $70 an hour, there's some who think that attorneys would wait to take on those cases until a county court would appoint them that case, because they could make $30 more at the $100 an hour rate, even if that rate was raised.
So are there concerns about these private attorneys also having to travel to meet with their clients?
Oh, yeah. Especially in northern Wisconsin, it's been a real problem up here in the Superior office, but more the Ashland office. And that area has, I think it's about 40 private practicing attorneys. And not all of them are criminal defense attorneys. You know, they all have their own specialized field. And they just can't make the case for spending time and money on that when they can make way more money doing other things in the area. A lot of times the Ashland office has a list about a dozen attorneys that they call on, but that are in the area. But most of the time it ends up where they'll have to make somewhere around 200 calls from the public defender's office, or even more. I've heard one judge in the area in northern Wisconsin has said that it took 2,000 calls for the public defender's office to find an attorney to represent someone on a case.
2,000, did you say?
2,000 calls. That's, they're touching base with 2,000 attorneys and they're saying no. So people are waiting an incredible amount of time right now to get representation.
We're talking with Danielle Kading. She is a WPR reporter based in Superior. We're looking at the pay for public defense attorneys and for private attorneys who represent. You can call in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the rate of pay for private attorneys in Wisconsin taking on public defense cases? Is $40 an hour inadequate? And if so, what would you raise it to? Are you an attorney? What are your thoughts here? Are you hesitant to take on public defender cases because of the money? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Danny, let's look in your neck of the woods in northern Wisconsin. Are we seeing fewer public defenders in northern Wisconsin, or is the caseload just getting heavier?
Well, I know that the state public defender's office would probably argue that they could always use more staff attorneys. But the real issue is that rural areas of the state don't have as many private practicing attorneys as urban areas. You know, the majority of attorneys reside in three counties in the state, and I think it's Dane, Milwaukee, and Waukesha counties. And so when these conflicts come up on cases and they need someone, at least in northern Wisconsin, oftentimes attorneys are coming from Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, Eau Claire, just because there's not enough attorneys in the rural areas to take on these cases, and because if they were to do it, they'd be taking it on at a financial loss.
Are attorneys coming in from out of state at all on contract work?
You know, that I do not know. I guess if that did happen, it wouldn't surprise me, but they'd have to be licensed to practice in both states.
Mm-hmm.
Which does happen. I could see that happening where a Duluth attorney might be traveling to take on a case in the Ashland area, but I can't say for sure.
Who is primarily impacted by this attorney shortage and the low pay rate for public defenders?
The impact is wide ranging. I mean, obviously, people who are charged with crimes are sitting in jail for weeks, sometimes months at a time. And that affects their ability to mount a defense against the charges, with the charges against them. And then you have victims who want to see this case tried, and they want to heal, and they want to move on. And that's part of their victim rights. And then you have the attorneys involved who are not making enough money. And that brings up an issue where if they're not making enough money on these cases, then they probably don't want to spend as much time on that. And there was a survey that was done that found that private practice attorneys that take on these cases spend 37% less time with these clients because they're just there's a financial conflict there for them. So it could tempt attorneys to, you know, get cases to plead quicker. They might not be devoting the resources that are needed to mount an adequate defense. And that's not fair to people who need effective representation under the U.S. Constitution.
And you've been following this issue for some time. What about the public defenders who stepped up to take some of these cases? Who are they?
Well, so the public defender's office would assign these cases to private attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
So the private attorneys that take on these cases are usually younger,
mm-hmm.
Recent graduates of law school, because a lot of the older, more experienced attorneys are not taking these cases anymore, according to the state public defender's office. So you have people who are taking on cases who don't have as much experience, and that becomes an issue the more complicated a case becomes.
We're talking with Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter in Superior, looking at public defender pay. Wisconsin Public Defender's Office is asking lawmakers to raise the rate for private attorneys assigned to represent clients who can't afford a lawyer. What do you think? How would you fix this system? 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about criminal justice pay and the state's criminal justice system on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state public defender's office assigns counsel on about 40% of its caseload, and delays in finding public defenders prompted a federal lawsuit last month. We're looking at the system and what the lawsuit alleges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where should public defense go from here? Are you an attorney? And if so, what are your thoughts here? Did a public defender take your case in the past? What was your experience like with the system? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior, and she's been covering this issue. Let's go right to the phones now with Paul joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. I just wanted to offer a little perspective on the inmate side of things and how they're receiving a lot of collateral damage from the high workload of the public defenders. I just spent a year in the Milwaukee County Jail, most of that working in the law library, and these guys rarely get in touch with their lawyers because their caseload is so high, and they are just so filled with anxiety and frustration. Many times it boils over, and it's just very frustrating for these guys when they don't know what's going on with their cases because their lawyers aren't keeping in touch because they're so busy. So I just wanted to offer that comment for you.
It sounds like communication between a client and the lawyer, it's not happening. There's a communication breakdown there.
That's certainly what came across when I was working in the law library. But most of these guys refer to their public defender as public pretenders because it just seems like they don't care because they just don't inform their clients of what's going on with the cases. And I'm not trying to blame them, the defenders, but, you know, if you're facing a crime and you have no idea what's going to be going on, even though you're going to court the next day, just imagine how frustrated you would be. You know, locked up and you have nothing else to think about. So I just wanted to put that out there so hopefully the public can.
Paul, thank you for your experience. Danny, you also reported on a class action lawsuit that's being brought in federal court, mm-hmm. prompted by the state's low rate of pay for public defenders. Can you give us some background there?
Yeah, and it's kind of related to what Paul was saying. And, you know, just kind of on what that note before I go into that and what he said, you know, one of the challenges for attorneys, you know, with the high caseloads, that's certainly it too. But if they were to say, just make a phone call to the jail or wherever they're being housed, then that could be recorded by authorities. So, you know, a lot of times they have to make these visits in person to update people on their cases. And at least in the case of Northern Wisconsin, if they have an attorney that's coming from Milwaukee or Madison, to have to make a 5 or 6 or 7 hour drive to be able to do that, it's very challenging for them to meet face to face to talk about the details of their case. But in the instance of this lawsuit, it involves 5 men and 1 woman, and they've alleged that their rights to a speedy trial have been violated. And the reason for that is they're spending several weeks. I think the worst case was a person was waiting 75 days in jail without representation. And that becomes an issue for cases where people have been charged with crimes, but there's, you know, they can't either post cash bail or they're being held for a good reason without bond. So, you know, the longer it takes, the more time that elapses, you know, for evidence to become either lost or for witnesses' recollection of an event to become hazy. And it just becomes more difficult for these people sitting in jail to represent themselves. And I think some of them often might be tempted to just represent themselves and forget about getting an attorney, but that's not good for them and that's not good for justice.
Let's bring in another call now. Alex is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment a couple things. Number one, that our whole democratic system is based on access to representation and the rule of law in this country. And that's one thing that sets us apart from other countries. So if this system is failing, we need to really look at how to fix it. But on the other hand, with the economic climate, I don't know how many other Americans feel sorry for somebody who's only making $40 an hour. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of sympathy for that. And so maybe one solution would be to force people who are just after their own bottom line, like sounds like a lot of these lawyers are, they just want to make money, to force them to take a number of these cases per year in order to keep their license.
Thank you, Alex. Danny, what about forcing private attorneys to take these cases and what the state public defender's office could do on that front?
You know, I don't know if that is something that they've considered, whether it's through legislation to actually force attorneys to take these cases. I imagine that that would be problematic. And I definitely sympathize with that thought that, you know, a lot of us are making way less than $40 an hour. So it seems like they're doing okay if they're making that amount of money. But what we're hearing from them is just with the time that they spend on these cases and the costs of operating a business, that that is not enough for them to keep going. And that can be an issue, especially in rural Wisconsin, because if we have offices closing, you know, private practices closing, then there are fewer attorneys in those areas. And that means that more attorneys from urban areas are going to have to travel to these parts of the state to represent these people. So I, while it is frustrating, and a lot of us would be happy to have $40 an hour, the reality is that attorneys are telling us that they're not taking these cases. And if they're not taking them, what are the options there?
You recently reported on this coalition of criminal justice agencies and associations that are working on a budget proposal package. And one of the requests in that proposal calls for this increase in compensation for those taking on public cases. So tell us about this proposal. What would it entail?
So it would raise the private bar compensation rate from $40 an hour to $70 an hour. And that would cost about $16 million more or so under the next or over each year of the next budget. And I believe they spend around $25 million a year already on assigned counsel, if I'm not mistaken. So it would be, you know, a significant added cost if that were raised.
Danny, you've been covering this issue for quite a while. What are you watching for as this goes forward?
What happens with the budget proposal? You know, is this something that Governor Evers is going to include in his proposal to the legislature? You know, in the legislature, there has been bipartisan support that this is a problem. Last year, Representative Evan Goyke, a Democrat, and Representative Ron Tussler, a Republican, they got together and put forward a bill that would raise the rate in a tiered system based on the level of complexity of these cases. That failed, but, you know, I think there is consensus among both Democrats and Republicans that this is an issue and one that needs to be addressed.
Well, Danny, thank you for joining us and bringing us up to speed.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior. She's the host of the regional program Hear Me Out, and we've been looking at the proposals put forth to raise the rate for private attorneys who take on cases. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.